Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Welcome, folks, to episode 2 of the Woody Overton Window, The Wow. It's June 10th, 2024. Woody is still under the weather, but I'm hopeful he'll be able to make his debut on The Wow in this Friday's episode. So if you missed last Friday's episode, I gave a rather lengthy explanation of why I am no longer part of Real Life Real Crime Daily, as well as how and why we chose the direction for this show, The Wow, which now drops every Friday and Monday on the Real Life Real Crime feed, or Real Life Real Crime Network, as I like to call it. On today's episode of The Wow, I examine whether there's a conflict of interest represented by the judge slated to preside in the Baton Rouge rape trial tied to the death of former LSU student Madison Brooks. Also, the star of a Netflix prison documentary is found dead in his cell. Was there foul play? What's happening in the WNBA? Is America a racist country? And is American racism driving the growth in ticket sales and television audiences to the WNBA? A hiker outsmarts a grizzly bear, a cold case is solved involving bad breath, and I stir up the new board with an oldie but goodie. First up, we've got the question of whether the judge appointed to preside over the Madison Brooks, Kayvon Washington case has a conflict of interest. This is a story, that broke in January of 2023. We covered it extensively. It involves an LSU student sorority member by the name of Madison Maddie Brooks, who was just 19 years old at the time of her death in January of 2023. The district judge, Gail Horn Ray, has been appointed to preside over the upcoming trial, and the state and East Baton Rouge Parish DA Hiller Moore are none too pleased about that. We've covered this case from the very beginning, and so if you're a new listener and unfamiliar with it, I would suggest you go back and listen to some of those episodes from mid-January of 2023, or just Google Madison Brooks case, and there is a ton of stuff there to look at. So under Louisiana law, the state must prove that Madison Brooks could not legally consent to sex because of a stupor brought on by alcohol intoxication. We know that the toxicology report came back saying Brooks was at a 3.19 blood alcohol level. And we also know that 0.08 is the legal limit in the state of Louisiana. And I think it is everywhere. I don't know of a state that's different. So experts say that being four times the legal limit, which is what you're talking about there, normally requires hospitalization and presents a risk of death. I mean, that four times the legal limit of alcohol in her blood. The case has taken on major racial overtones as the DA indicted all four locals and specifically Kayvon Washington and an unnamed minor on first-degree rape and video voyeurism charges. As I said, the case has been handed to controversial District Judge Gail Horn Ray. Judge Ray has been involved in a number of controversial decisions in the recent past where her decisions seem potentially biased. She released a guy by the name of DeAndre Cox, who was accused of raping his preteen neighbor. And when they released him, they did not alert the victim or notify the DA's office. That appears to be a violation. She also vacated the 50-year-old conviction of another rapist because she said the jury was given, quote, improper instructions during the trial, which she called a, quote, glaring error. This judge also represented her own son in a trial where he was convicted of serial rape charges. And so all of this has caused the DA to appeal her fitness to preside over the case. This decision has actually gone all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, which will decide whether Judge Ray should recuse herself from the case or not. So the case has basically been stalled pending this decision coming from the Supreme Court. I guess they are expecting it's going to come fairly soon because everything I read says that The trial will happen sometime this fall. The trial will be held in a parish, East Baton Rouge Parish, that is basically 50% white and 50%, I think it's 47% white, 47% black, and 6% or so Latino. So we can expect to see a jury that's 7-5 white, black, 6-6, 7-5 black, white, something like that. 6-5 and one Latino, some kind of makeup like that. It's going to pretty closely mirror the population, right? I've heard nothing but amazing things from Woody about DA Hiller Moore, but you know, I think this is going to be a tough case and a tough case to get a conviction on for a number of reasons. As I've said from the very beginning of the case, I've got a certain amount of empathy for these men, I guess, young men, accused as, you know, at least from some of the videos I've seen, there was a certain amount of aggressiveness coming from the victim here. These guys were leaving the bar without her. She followed them to their car. And then after some conversation, she talked her way or was invited into the car. No one inside the bar or outside the bar appeared to try to stop her from what I could see, again, on the video that has been publicly released. I know there's a lot of video that hasn't been released. So don't know what that will show and how that would alter opinions there. But what happened in that car next was, you know, morally reprehensible, disgusting. I mean, any one of these four young men in the vehicle could have prevented the tragedy. Any one of them could have realized she was compromised and done the right thing. Any one of them could have and should have made sure she arrived home safely. So instead, they took advantage of her. Her pursuit of them isn't justification for what they did from a legal standpoint, but it was possibly or even likely that they didn't understand necessarily how drunk she actually was and that what she was saying does not amount to, quote, consent under certain circumstances. So, you know, ignorance is never a defense under the law, but this case, again, might be viewed a little bit differently. Here's what the Louisiana law states. It says, any person who commits a sexual act upon another person when the other person is incapable of consenting to the sexual act due to any impairment by any drug, intoxicant, or other substance, and that condition is known or reasonably should be known by the person, is guilty of sexual assault. I'm no lawyer, but where it says, and that condition is known or reasonably should be known by the person, is where I think things get a little dicey on this case. What will a jury think these young men should have reasonably known? I think that's kind of the essence of the case. And lately, we've witnessed a number of these jury trials where the verdicts aligned more with the politics than they did with the law. The country's split and split in a really unhealthy way right now. And, you know, you often see a liberal found guilty in a red city, a conservative found guilty in a blue city. It's become more about jury selection than making a judgment based upon the facts and evidence and the law. In a large number of these cases, we witnessed elected judges with strong political opinions influence the direction of admitted evidence, expert witness testimony. We've seen them sustain or overrule objections based upon some bias, deliver jury instructions, and ultimately influence verdicts in a pretty meaningful way. So this is happening in very high visibility cases. One will go without mention here. So everyone sees it. I mean, it's out there. Everyone sees it. It's evident. So I can only imagine what's happening in lower courts if this kind of stuff is going on in the high courts. So if the Supreme Court rules that Judge Ray does not have to recuse herself, the trial will be overseen by a judge who defended her own son in a serial rape case, released two other convicted rapists early for questionable reasons. She also obviously happens to be black, and you're going to have a jury that is going to be very split racially. My instincts, having looked at all of these other cases, tell me that we stand a large chance of ending up in a mistrial here and a hung jury. But again, a lot of evidence not out there yet, a lot of battling going on as far as what will be and will not be admissible in this case, and obviously a very big decision that rests with the highest court in the land. So as I said, the case is expected to go to trial sometime this fall, and many, many eyes across the country, and especially here in the state of Louisiana, will be on it. Moving along, one of the stars of a controversial Netflix prison documentary, which is called Unlocked, was found dead in his cell at the age of 29. This is just 30 days before he was due to be released. This is an interesting situation here. This guy, John Eastside McAllister, his nickname is Eastside, was found dead in his bunk in the Pulaski Correctional Center, which is in Arkansas. This happened a week ago, Sunday, June 2nd. His family said that the inmate's cause of death has not been established. I checked as recently as this morning, and it has still not been established from what I can find. Unlocked is basically a jail experiment. Inmates are given a degree of independence and autonomy that they wouldn't ordinarily have within a prison. Murder and suicide have apparently been ruled out by the officials in this case. McAllister was serving time for 10 drug-related felony accounts, breaking and entering, theft of property, gun possession. He pleaded guilty in 2023. He was sentenced to 3 years hard time. He had a long criminal history that began at the age of 19. Basically, he's been in and out of prison. He's done 14 different, he had done 14 different stretches in prison. On the show, McAllister is allowed to run a tattoo parlor from inside his prison cell. So during one episode, he explained that being on the wrong side of the law gave him an adrenaline rush and that he spent his life around criminals. Last month, Pulaski County Sheriff Eric Higgins defended the decision to allow the series to be filmed at the county jail. The decision has prompted scrutiny from local and state officials who said they weren't aware of this and they didn't find out until the very last minute, like right before the show premiered. The series focuses on a six-week experiment. They give inmates in one cell block all of this freedom. They unlock their cell doors and basically they're allowed to live free within a prison for a six-week period of time. Higgins said he did not approach Netflix or the production company that filmed the series beforehand. So I took action to ensure that we have a reentry program to help those who are booked into our facility to come out and be better individuals. That's what Higgins told members of the Joint Performance Review Committee that's looking into the case. Arkansas Senator Jonathan Dismang said that he doesn't have a problem with the sheriff's reentry program or trying something new to address recidivism, but he said that he was concerned with it being the focus of a TV show and questioned how it could be considered an experiment when it was already being filmed. So he said, I think it's an exploitation of your prisoners that you allowed a film crew to come in. So Pulaski County Judge Barry Hyde weighed in, and this guy's the top elected official in the county. And he said he wasn't aware of the series until he saw a trailer before it premiered. Hyde said that the agreement between the sheriff, that's Higgins, and the production company was illegal because Hyde needed to sign it and he didn't sign it. The county has since returned a $60,000 check from the production company. I'm actually surprised it was that small. But, what could go wrong with allowing a lifelong criminal to operate a tattoo business out of an open prison cell? So, I really wish Woody was here for this one, because I'm sure he'd have a lot of thoughts on this case. But, I know they're trying lots of creative approaches in the name of lowering these recidivism rates and trying to provide, alternative trades, a way to emerge from prison and make a solid living and not turn back to crime. But definitely a lot of questions here. Also on Netflix side, I'm shocked that they went in. Well, actually, probably the liability lays with the production company, not Netflix. And so it's more the liability on the production company side. But I haven't seen it. I'm going to watch it because of hearing all of this. And I'm skeptical of this no foul play expected. You got a 29-year-old, 30 days from being released from prison. He's running a tattoo business for 6 weeks out of his open cell. This one's a little stinky. So we'll see what we hear next, and I'll make sure Woody weighs in with us when we get together. I'm a huge fan of Caitlin Clark, and therefore ESPN and some higher profile WNBA players say, I must be a racist. This is a sports story, but it's really more of a cultural story and more of a story about where we are here in the United States in 2024, in my opinion. Given the rivalry that developed in college between LSU and Caitlin Clark's Iowa team, a lot of you listening are probably more familiar with Caitlin Clark than you would otherwise be. But, you know, here's a synopsis for everyone else. Caitlin Clark is a professional women's basketball player who was recently taken as the number one player in the WNBA draft by a team called the Indiana Fever. In college, she set all kinds of scoring records, all kinds of three-point shooting records, and she led this Iowa team to two successive appearances in the national championship game. In 23, they lost that game to LSU. And then this year, they beat LSU in the semifinals and then lost to an undefeated University of South Carolina team in the finals. So 2 years in a row, she brought the team to the finals. But a major rivalry developed between Clark and LSU star Angel Reese as they went head-to-head in these two big games in college. And that rivalry has extended over to the WNBA as Reese was also a top pick in this most recent draft. And she's now playing for the Chicago Sky, which I think is same division as the Indiana Fever. So she and Clark are going to play against each other a lot and for a lot of years, I would imagine. Caitlin Clark is white. Caitlin Clark is also heterosexual. And according to the cast of The View, Caitlin Clark is, quote, pretty. Okay, I'm not going to argue that one. They and others have labeled Clark as, quote, privileged, both on the basis of her skin color and her attractiveness. So she's got both white privilege and pretty privilege. And therefore, these people claim it's racism that has catapulted Clark's popularity. And she has become the most popular female basketball player of all time in a very short period of time. Since Clark emerged as a star in college and now in the pros, revenue for the team she played for and the leagues that she played in has soared. So her popularity has grown not just the opportunity for the team she plays on, but also for the league in general. And so the old, you know, rising tide lifts all boats. I mean, her popularity has propelled the sport, both in college and the pros. You know, crowds have never been near as big as they are right now, and revenues have never been near as high as they are right now in the WNBA. And frankly, the WNBA itself has really been a lost leader. It's owned by the NBA. And so the NBA can afford to lose millions if they need to lose millions. And so basically it's a public relations move. The entire league has been on behalf of the NBA for years and years. I don't believe it's ever turned a profit. Could be wrong about that, but I don't think they've ever turned a profit. So, you know, given this dynamic, you might think, again, that there would be a sense of appreciation or respect for Clark, as she's definitely paved the way to greater opportunities for many other WNBA players. But that's not really what has turned out to be the case. The WNBA is 70% Black and about 30% alternative lifestyle. And I have no idea really how to estimate this, but, you know, let's just say it's 50% not pretty or unattractive. And I only say that because you have all of these people labeling her as pretty privileged or attractive privileged. So the newfound popularity of the league is not driven by the racism of Caitlin Clark fans, but rather, I think, the interest of fans of all backgrounds who are witnessing a player who's transcending the game and doing so with leadership, character, and class. Let me make my case. The NBA player, I think, is the best comp, or the player I think of when I'm trying to draw a comparison to Caitlin Clark, is Stephen Curry. When Steph burst onto the scene by taking a relatively unknown Davidson College team deep into the NCAA tournament, he quickly became a fan favorite. He didn't become a fan favorite because he's Black and all the Black racists were just waiting for a Black player to emerge that could get them excited about watching the NBA again. Steph became a phenomenon like Caitlin Clark hopes to become because he was so different and he was such an underdog. You know, he could shoot the ball. still does to this day, accurately from distances that no one had ever shot the ball accurately from. And his ability to do that really changed the nature of the NBA for good. It wasn't a racial thing with Steph Curry. It was an underdog thing. He was very small for his position. He looked like a baby. And undersized kids all over the United States, with Steph in the news and becoming famous, now realize that they could maybe make their junior high team or make their high school team if they could handle the ball and shoot the step back three that made Steph famous. And so he developed a following in the way that he changed the game that had an impact all the way down to 4 and 5 year olds who are emulating him, and include my own son in that. And I want to share a personal story there. My kids went to a number of basketball camps over the years. They went to Michael Jordan's camp. They went to Derek Fisher's camp, but there was something very different about Steph Curry's camp where they also went. Steph held that camp on the campus of a prep school up in Northern California. So all the kids that attended the camp would stay in the dorms overnight, and so did Steph. I remember one of the nights that I showed up at about, I don't know, 8 or 9 p.m. It was barely dark, and I had to drop off something for my son. And when I looked in, all of the kids were watching some movie in this large open room. There were maybe, I shouldn't say all the kids, there were maybe 20 or 30 kids in there. But as I looked in, I could see in the middle of the floor, laying down alongside all of these kids and clowning around with them with a handful of a box full of popcorn, was Stephen Curry. You know, some people excel in a sport and then get to the pros and are expected to become a role model for kids and, you know, fail miserably because they're not capable of living up to those expectations. It's just not who they are. But Steph Curry was and is everything he was advertised to be. And I'd say, and even more than that. And that's why he transcended the game. It's not because of or in spite of his skin color. It's because of what he was capable of as a player. Still is pretty much capable of as a player, and what he stood for as a human being. I bet if you asked his longtime coach, Steve Kerr, what traits of Steph's he thinks are most important, and played the biggest role in the Golden State Warriors winning 4 NBA championships with Steph. I bet he would say his leadership and his character before he would start mentioning any of his athletic skills, his shooting ability or his ball handling ability, et cetera. For those of us who have jumped on board the Caitlin Clark bandwagon, it's because we all see a similar combination of an underdog with game-changing skills that has brought life into a sport or back into a sport that was struggling. Young girls all across the country are working really hard today on developing an accurate three-point shot with a quick release so that they can have a shot of playing high school ball or beyond. Mothers and fathers are anxious to see if Caitlin can live up to the expectations placed upon her from a leadership and character standpoint. But many players in the league don't see it this way. There's a player by the name of Asia Wilson who is a star, a big star in the league. She plays for the Las Vegas Aces, and she was quoted in an article this week saying, "I think a lot of people may say it's not about black and white, but to me, it is. You can be top-notch at what you are as a black woman, but they don't see it. They don't see it as a marketable and hardworking black woman are swept underneath the rug. When people deny that Caitlin Clark's stature is driven by race, it boils my blood." But to see what's happening here only through that lens disregards the larger point. Clark's different in other ways. I mean, over the years, the WNBA has had plenty of great white players, like probably the greatest WNBA player of all time, Diana Taurasi, Sue Bird. I mean, there are others, but you know, Taurasi is considered to be the greatest player in league's history. She's won 3 NBA titles. She's been an All-Star 10 times. She was first team WNBA 10 times. She's been a league MVP. And yet, as great as Taurasi is, she really couldn't grow the game other than in Phoenix, where she has played and won multiple championships. And so you know, where were all the racists during Taurasi's ascent? The leagues had many great black players as well. Players like Lisa Leslie, Candace Parker, and Breonna Taylor, all superstars, all popular in their home cities, but none that was able to change the league from a fan interest standpoint, none that was able to put more bodies in seats and sell television rights, get sponsorships, all of that kind of stuff. So yes, Clark is straight. Yes, she's white. And I suppose, yes, she's pretty. And yes, she's breaking into a league that could be described as queer, black, and unattractive based upon, again, what we've already talked about. But if it was about white America laying in wait for a player that they could get behind and call their own, Diana Taurasi would have been that player a long time ago. And consider the case with Tiger Woods and golf. With Tiger, it was a black guy coming into a sport that had been dominated by white players forever, right? But Tiger could hit it further. He could hit it more accurately. He could putt with precision. If he was ahead on a Saturday, he was never going to lose that tournament. He brought a level of physical fitness and intensity that the sport had never had before. And so, yes, he woke up an entire generation of black kids to the thought that they could play this game, but he didn't become the largest singular athletic brand in history because suddenly black people cared about golf. He became what he became before his fall from grace, obviously, because he built a global fan base of every race, creed, religion, et cetera, and sexual orientation. And he built that fan base because he was different and better. And for a long time, we all believed he was a leader and a person of character. If tomorrow a black kid from the inner city of Detroit were to emerge as the fastest skater in history with the fastest and most accurate slap shot in history, that player would be embraced in the United States. They'd be embraced in Canada like nothing you've ever seen before because they would have transcended that sport. They would have the capability of changing hockey forever. And so if the world actually operated the way Asia Wilson or the host of The View say it does, the success of Stephen Curry, Tiger Woods, or Simone Biles would have been impossible. Caitlin Clark has the chance to transcend the WNBA, but will the league let it happen? Will the players in the league let it happen? Just last night, she set a WNBA rookie record with 7 3-pointers, and she scored 30 points in a big victory for that Indiana team. So I say, go, Caitlin. A Massachusetts man went on a hiking adventure in Wyoming's Grand Teton National Park and got a bigger adventure than he had bargained for. Grand Teton Park Rangers reported that a man was seriously injured when he encountered a bear in the Signal Mountain Summit area. Park Rangers, along with Teton County Search and Rescue, responded to the scene to provide emergency medical care and airlifted the patient via helicopter to an ambulance where he was transported to an area hospital. This man, who's 35, was in stable condition and expected to recover. The park also said that the incident may have been a surprise encounter involving the man and two grizzly bears. That would not be a fun encounter. The man was not identified, but he told officials that he encountered a small bear first, and that bear ran away from him. And then he sort of sensed something, and he thought that he better go get his bear spray out of his backpack. And so he grabbed this canister of bear spray, and just as he was grabbing it and got it in his hand from the backpack, a much larger grizzly came at him. He fell to the ground, and before he could and didn't in that motion have an opportunity to deploy any of this bear spray. And so he hit the ground, and his instinct was to play dead, which, God, I just don't know in a situation like that, in an encounter like that, that instinct would kick in and I'd be able to do that. But that's what the guy did. And amazingly, so the bear, the guy had his fingers like wrapped around his neck to protect himself. If you're face down, obviously that's a very vulnerable spot. And so he's got a hand over his neck, and that same hand was attached, had a finger that was attached to that canister of bear spray. So he was bitten several times by the bear, but then the bear took a bite out of that canister and the canister burst immediately. And when it did, both of the bears took off running. Can you believe that? First of all, if you don't have the instinct to do what the guy did, you're dead. If you don't get there fast enough and get that canister and have contact with a finger on it, he's dead. And he still needed a lot of luck. He needed a bear to make the mistake of taking a bite out of the wrong thing, and that's what the bear did. So, you know, this guy was able to then get to an area as those bears ran away where he had some cell phone coverage, because he didn't in the spot where the encounter occurred, and was able to call for help. And park officials said that the bear who bit the man won't be captured and killed because the animal was probably just trying to protect its cub. I mean, obviously it was trying to protect its cub. And so this is not one of those cases where these guys are going out and they're going to shoot the animal. The Grand Teton National Park, in its statement about the incident, offered tips on avoiding human bear conflicts. Among them, not leaving food unattended unless it is secured, giving the bear space if you see one, and staying away from the animal by at least a distance of 100 yards, and not eating or cooking in a tent. A lot of experienced campers listening to the show probably already know all that stuff. With all the crazy stuff that that Woody has done over the years and all of his hunting, I would have loved to ask him about the wildest encounter he has had, but we'll get to that on Friday when we are with him. This next story, I mean, it's a story about a rapist, and so I don't want to laugh at some of the things in here, but there are some things here that are hard not to laugh at. Okay, so you know, more than 16 years have passed since a man disappeared following his sexual assault conviction in Massachusetts. The man became known as the Bad Breath Rapist. The Bad Breath Rapist. He is now behind bars, but I want to tell you the story here. The U.S. Marshal Service arrested 55-year-old Tuin Dickey Kit Lee, on Tuesday, May 28th, is when the arrest happened. It happened in the town of Diablo, California, which I had never heard of, but it is in the East Bay suburbs of San Francisco Bay Area. Lee broke into a coworker's home back on February 2nd of 2005. This was in Quincy, Massachusetts, which is suburban Boston, where he tied her up and he raped her. The victim was able to identify Lee as her attacker because of his awful breath, and thus his nickname became the Bad Breath Rapist. You know, it's difficult to get inside the head of a rapist, but we've always heard it's a crime about power, not a crime of passion, right? So, you know, can you imagine being some crazed, woman-hating, narcissist, serial rapist? You're a sick, violent disease of a person, and you turn on the news and you see that they've labeled you the Bad Breath Rapist. I mean, it can't be good for that diseased mind of this guy's. But anyway, authorities obtained DNA evidence, and in September of 2007, this guy was convicted of both rape and kidnapping. But somehow, he was allowed to remain out of jail prior to sentencing. I don't know, maybe the court empathized with his embarrassment about his breath. I don't know, but they didn't lock him up. Well, surprise, surprise. Lee took off before being sentenced, and he's been on the lam popping Tic Tacs for nearly two decades, despite media campaigns and an appearance on America's Most Wanted. I can just see Dylan Walsh on America's Most Wanted. You know, if you smell this man, please call the hotline at blah, blah, blah. I mean, it's crazy. Investigators got a break in this case when they found a picture of a man who appeared to be Lee on social media. Marshals found an address at a multi-million-dollar home in Diablo, California, owned by a flower shop owner. So, okay. I just have to say that one of the obvious hiding places for Captain Halitosis here would be in a flower shop that could hide his scent. So the U.S. Marshal Service and local Massachusetts authorities confirmed Lee was staying at this location. Cops staked out the place, And a day or two later, they saw a man and a woman leaving the home in a car. The Danville police, which is another nice suburb on the Oakland side of the Bay, pulled them over. Lee allegedly gave officers a fake name at first, but eventually admitted to his true identity, which was confirmed. I know what you're thinking, but no, they used fingerprints to confirm his ID. The flower shop woman and Lee had been companions for 15 years, and she never knew who Lee was or anything about his arrest. So I wonder what kind of greeting Mr. Lee, the bad breath rapist, is going to get on his cell block. I doubt he'll be able to hide amongst the tulips and roses when he gets to that place. Okay, so I wanted to end this episode with a segment that was one of my favorites to do on The Daily Show and regularly caused Jim Chapman to have seizures. But yes, it's the Stuff I'm Not Allowed to Report, and it's back here on The Wow. So even though I've been given a good deal of rope by Woody here in The Wow, there are still some no-nos, but fuck it. I'd really like to report on the trial of the crack-addicted sexual deviant who collected cash from all over the globe for his pops, POTUS, a.k.a. the big guy, but I can't. I'm not allowed to report on it. I'd hoped to interview former Baton Rouge resident Stormy Daniels to see if she could provide a more detailed description of DJT's member than the, quote, smaller than average with a huge mushroom head description she mentioned during testimony. But I couldn't. I'm not allowed to report on it. I wanted to report how during Biden's trip to Normandy, France this week, he was overheard whispering to President Macron, quote, my wife is still hot, but yours looks like a beaver. But I can't. I'm not allowed to report on it. I wanted to report on the good news from Dr. Fauci's congressional testimony this week. The good doctor reports that the 6 feet of social distancing rule was carefully researched and delicately extracted from the anal cavity of someone at the CDC. I also wanted to report that Fauci further reported that it was that same rectal extraction that determined it was a good idea to put masks on kindergartners. But have no fear, because I'd also like to report that Dr. Fauci was so sure that the virus was not the result of a lab leak in Wuhan that he conspired with a group of virologists to cover up their participation in gain-of-function research. And I'd like to report that we also learned that pharmaceutical companies paid $710 million in royalties to the Fauci-led National Institute of Health between 2021 and 2023. But no worries, friends, because I'm not allowed to report on any of it. I'd like to report the good news that the government says reporting shows violent crime arrests are down dramatically in major cities across the U.S. And I'd also like to report that cops say they no longer bother arresting anyone because DAs let them go immediately anyway. But unfortunately, I'm not allowed to report on any of it. And finally, I'd like to report that Friday's audience for the show was larger than any Friday audience the entire time I was in exile. But I can't. I'm not allowed to report on it. Talk to you Friday. Aglets!